Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Hello and welcome. I'm Neville Hawcock, and this week on the Arts Podcast, we'll be talking about the music awards season. Barely a day goes by this month without a statuette changing hands against a deafening background of mutual backslapping. Well, perhaps I exaggerate a little. But Sunday the 13th sees the Grammys in Los Angeles, Tuesday the 15th sees the Brits in London, while the indie-focused NME Awards are dished out on February 23rd. With me in the studio are the FT's pop critics, Ludo Hunter-Tilney and Richard Clayton. Ludo, the Brits have revamped themselves this year. According to the popular tabloid newspaper The Sun, a source said, the new committee is ripping the guts out of the old Brits. So what precisely are they up to?
I think that they're transferring the old guts, to continue with that analogy, into a smart new chassis or body. Namely, they're moving from Earl's Court, which is a rather tatty venue these days, to the O2 Arena, which is the world's most successful concert venue. So they've got a whizzy new venue in which it'll take place, much bigger. The O2 Arena holds some 20,000 people. And the statuettes, which they're going to hand out, have been redesigned by none other than Vivienne Westwood, who will be presumably giving them a punky cast. She was the partner of Malcolm McLaren.
I think it's a rather Union Jackie sort of makeover from what I've seen of them.
That would fit with the Brits theme, I suppose.
Nice touch.
Yeah, very good. We'll go back. I mean, Union Jack theme was a great part of Westwood's work in the 70s with the Sex Pistols and such like. They're going to be having the Lifetime Achievement Award that the Brits used to give out to some old-timer has now been dropped. It's clearly they want to give a sort of image of British music as forward and youthful, and they're not going to have any of the dinosaurs, the oasises of this world, clogging up the stage at the very end. And I think that the whole thing is now, it's once more going to be produced live on television, where they're going to be showing it, which I think Richard can tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, David Joseph is the new chairman of the Brits. He's from Universal Music. And live, making it live again, yes. I mean, the thing with the Brits was that it always used to be a bit of a ramshackle affair, very unpredictable, most famously in 1989 when Sam Fox, the topless model, and Mick Fleetwood, the very tall drummer from Fleetwood Mac, had a legion of problems with the auto cue, and it was very compelling, but real car crash TV. Since then, there have been a couple of other high points, notably when Jarvis Cocker bared his bottom during a Michael Jackson performance, the very egregious Earth song, which everyone in Britain thought was far too over the top. So there have been these incredible moments, but it's always been the unscripted ones that the Brits have been famous for. Now, what David Joseph is doing now, I think, is slightly trying to have it both ways. He talks about it being a must-see spectacle, but at the same time wants more gravitas about the music. And I don't necessarily see that those go together very well.
On that same note, it'll be interesting to see if any politicians turn up this year, because it used to be politicians would flock to the Brits, but this practice was literally, there was a dampener put on it when a member of the anarchist pop group Chumbawamba, who went by the name of Norbert No Bacon, drenched John Prescott, then Deputy Prime Minister, with water in protest at some government policy or other. And since then they've kept away. But now, will there be anyone from the government at the current Brit Awards in today's heightened political climate?
Well, more to the point as well, I mean, will the rock and pop stars be able to hold their liquor? Because they always used to get very jolly. And that was, again, one of the classic things about the Brits, that no one really would be listening to who was on stage. And again, David Joseph this time has said that he's concerned about the raucous element, and they used to confirm stereotypes. So it seems to me more like a kind of bugler for the business rather than anything that's actually going to let the creative types let their hair down.
And I'm not sure if we do want to have a slick, highly produced Brits either. The thing for which it's famous, infamous, is for when things go wrong, which after all does live up to the sort of pop reputation for no holds barred transgressiveness and fun. We remember it for things like Joss Stone and her rubbish American accent that she used when she accepted an award. Yes. She was barracked afterwards. We remember it for Liam Gallagher and Robbie Williams offering to go out and fight each other, you know, in what would have been one of the sort of lightweight bout of the century.
So it sounds as if the format of the awards is potentially going to be a lot tamer. How are the nominees actually decided? I think that's changed this year as well, hasn't it?
No, it hasn't changed this year. I mean, they've allowed winners from previous years to vote, but that's only a few people. They have 1,000 industry insiders, of which I count myself a member, voting upon who should win, and the various nominees arise from that. And this year, the list of nominees is quite low on pun rock, I notice. There's not much rock going on there.
Well, no, we live in very pop-tastic times, don't we? And there is a few smatterings of X Factor alumni as well in there, which I suppose, yeah, symptomatic of what's popular at the moment, not necessarily what's good. But
ones who have got the most nominees. For instance, we have Tiny Temper, one of the new generation of British rappers who's been nominated multiple times. There's also Plan B, the rapper turned soul singer. He's also got a number of nominations. He's a very interesting act.
Yes, and then Paul Weller and Robert Plant, who were obviously two of the candidates who would have been up for Lifetime Achievement had they still got it in there, but still very vital and making fresh new stuff, obviously in their own ways. And then Mark Ronson, bringing up the rear, definitely, I think, in a way, because he's more of a New Yorker than a Brit, really. Although that pop album was, you know, good fun, I think. More than I was expecting from him, certainly.
I think the problem this year possibly could be, regardless of its scripted nature, is going to be the fact that it could be quite predictable. I think the winners are quite easy to pick. I mean, I'll put my head on the chopping block here.
Go on, then.
And suggest to you that the winner of the British Male Solo Artist, who are Mark Ronson, Paul Weller, Plan B, Robert Plant and Tiny Temper, is going to be a battle between Plan B and Tiny Temper. And I would say Plan B will be the one who takes that.
I think you're right there.
Defamation of Strickland. What's the last bit of that, Richard?
Strickland.
Thank you very much. Fellow rock critic Richard Clayton.
Yes.
And for the best British female solo artist, we have Cheryl Cole, Ellie Goulding, Laura Marling, Paloma Faith and Rumour. I think Rumour is a shoe-in for that as well.
And I'd love to see Laura Marling, will it? But I don't think she will. The most interesting category probably is international female, actually, which, again, probably shows the temperature of pop at the moment. We've got Rihanna in there and
Alicia Keys and Katy Perry,
yes,
Robin and Kylie.
Yeah, so, I mean, Rihanna and Robin, I think, are the hot tips there.
I would suggest to you, as Rihanna is playing, she's a lockdown for the award, not least because a few years back, she suffered the indignity of doing a duet with the Claxons at the Brits.
God,
so I think only to apologise for making her share a stage with that hapless bunch of indie dancers, they'll be giving her the gong.
Ludo, you've made a bold claim there about it being a toss-up between Tiny Temper and Plan B for the British male solo artist. Let's take a chance to listen to Tiny Temper performing Pass Out. Yeah, yeah, we bring the stars out. We bring the women and the cars out. Let's have a toast of celebration, get a glass out. And we can do this until we pass out. Let it be. Well, that's Tiny Temper there, who's nominated in several categories at the Brits. Also nominated in at least two of the categories, for British Breakthrough Act and for British Group, in fact. And by way of complete contrast is Mumford & Sons. Let's do a compare and contrast and listen to them singing The Cave. Complete contrast with Tiny Temper. Is it a bit of a? Are we seeing a bit of a back to basics move here? This focus.
Those two bands do sum up quite neatly, and this is the use of the Brits. They sum up quite neatly two contrasting poles of British music currently. On the one hand, you have the Mumford and Sons, who are from quite a posh background, frankly. They're part of the many pop and rock stars today who've had private educations, recently estimated at 60% today's chart rock and pop acts. They play a sort of an old-fashioned, faux authentic, folky sort of music. On the other hand, you have Tiny Temper, who is from, he's from Plumstead, which isn't the roughest part of London, for those who don't know that.
He's got his parts.
That suburb. But he is part of the sort of urban, much more technologically adept and savvy generation. You feel that the two of them do present very good contrasting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Tiny Temper, that song got a boost by being on an advert for a computer game, and it's got that kind of tinniness as well of computer graphics and sounds. going on in it. It's got a bit of a dubstep influence as well, and there's some great lyrics about how he's got more clothes he knows what to do with, so he leaves them at his aunt's house. I mean, it's a lovely mixture of the kind of the bragging rights that rap obviously has, but with a kind of very English sort of modesty thing going on in it. It comes from an album which isn't necessarily a comprehensive record, but he's certainly a good singles artist, I think. And I'm very pro the whole upsurge and of this kind of British urban pop, and the fact that it is very multicultural actually as well. You've got, you know, black and white kids who are both, you know, loving this stuff equally, and the generic boundaries don't really exist so much, I think, in the UK, perhaps, whereas they do in the Grammys, where you've got awards for every single subgenre of music going.
But the difference with this is there is no Brits award for hip hop, R&B, urban music. And in fact, one of the biggest trends of last year, dubstep, as you just mentioned, isn't even recognised by the Brits, which is a way, is one of the sort of problems of this particular award, that it is very slow to react to things. It's obviously very music industry based. It's to do with big artists whom they want to be able to sell lots of records of. But it misses out things like dubstep, which have clearly come up.
I think I'd like to have a few more categories. Certainly, you know, dubstep or an urban category would be one. I think genuine folk as well, because Mumford's is definitely the kind of yummy mummy friendly organic yogurt sort of version of folk, rather than the much more traditional stuff where it's the Unthanks or Chris Wood or even the venerable Richard Thompson who are out there. But it's not going to really rock.
If there was a folk category, the droves of people turning off on ITV would be so immense as to cause
it would be good for them. It would be good for them. So I think there should be some. But at the same time, I quite like the fact that there aren't these distinctions, and that there is just one pop category, and then pop represents all the kind of stuff that is going on at once. Because as I say, I think that multicultural aspect of British pop, which is sort of Dizzy Rascal has kind of started, and the way he's gone more and more pop in his career, is a good thing.
It's curious that you say that, because this is the point at which multiculturalism is meant to have failed, if we're to believe.
Well, exactly.
David,
I mean, I don't want to get, you know, political or equally naive here, but I always thought multiculturalism meant a kind of mixing of things. And I always think of it as, you know, being Britain's love for a curry, and the fact that, you know, Massive Attack came out of the sound system scene in Bristol and you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it'd be quite good to even have a Bangra category as well, because, you know, that's British Asian music with a kind of drum and bass influence.
Well, British pop music is itself a form of multiculturalism, in as much as it's a sort of national language which has been formed from an American one. It came from America, yet has become immensely successful. It's Britain's most successful cultural export. The Brits, in comparison to any other awards show, is way above there. Things like the BAFTAs, no one gives a King's Speech about, but something like the Brits is watched on television. It is our Oscars. I mean, and it is also a product of, as it were, cultural sort of warp and weft.
But I don't think there's even a Bangra category in the 109 categories that comprise the Grammys. It's a truly extraordinary taxonomy.
there is, yes.
Well, am I mistaken there?
No, there isn't. But the one that they missed out, apparently, because they couldn't get enough entries for, was a regional Mexican album, which is a bit of an oversight. I did notice there's also a Best New Age album, and two of the records up for there were Instrumental Oasis Volume 4, which I don't think is something that Noel put out, having stripped off Liam's vocals, and also Sacred Journey of the Kukai Volume 4, which might be something to do with that James Cameron film that everyone was going mad about last year.
The Grammys is a remarkable, vast, floating liner cruise ship of an awards show. It was even a pre-Grammys show on television, which was hosted by LL Cool J, whose name a Welsh wit once told me, had he been from Wales, would be Cool J. Anyway, he hosted the pre-Grammy Awards show, which was an hour long on primetime telly, which was just to announce the nominees. So the Grammy is this vast, vast, vast thing. But I mean, some of it is just mystifying. What's the difference, can anyone explain, Richard, between best song and best record?
Well, I was wondering that myself. I mean, perhaps it's something to do with, you know, best song has more lyrical content and record is more about the sonics that go in it. But, I mean, that's just my guess. Yeah, I mean, it's that all shall have prizes kind of thing, which is that American dream or British promise? I don't know. But
I think it was, you mentioned gravitas earlier about the Brit Awards, the Brits lacking gravitas and being a sort of cheekier, more irreverent, whatever their attempts to try and rebrand it. And I think that the Grammys does have that monumental, very sort of graven, lapidary, written in stone quality.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of supersized awards, isn't it? I mean, you really would feel bloated after, you know, consuming all of those awards if they were a smorgasbord of treats.
You'd feel exhausted sitting through it. It'd be like the longest prog rock concert ever.
But it's, it kind of grinds you down, perhaps, with its authenticity in a way, whereas the Brits, as you say, is more irreverent. But, yeah, again, this David Joseph chap, he's talked about having a must-see spectacle, which, you know, does suggest he wants to sort of capture that red carpet thing, but perhaps also a nod to the old, more raucous history of the Brits, but at the same time wants some gravitas. So I think there's a bit of a mixed message there, particularly, as you said earlier, of dropping the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, we'll just have to see what the near future holds, because that's all we have time for now. Thanks to my studio guests, Ludo Hunter-Tilney and Richard Clayton, and to you for listening. The Arts Podcast was produced by Griselda Murray-Brown. Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.